brainwashed by all the rules, brainwashed by our leaders, by our kings and queens, brainwashed in the open and brainwashed behind the scenes.
Highly confused.
He is enormous.
Let's challenge his shattered view of the world.
Here's a little wedge for the never believer. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Load of audio clips to play for you, all very interesting in each their own way. Maybe a quick analysis here or there. If you do want to call in, the number for that is going to be 1-877-REVERE-0. We got a chat room up. You want to go to revereradio.org, and where it says chat, you want to click that right there. And that will take you, bim, bam, boom, straight to the chat room, and you can talk to all the Revere luminaries there. There is also a donate button, so we can keep this network running on donations and expand. And, you know, when after we pay off the bills for the month, if we get enough donations, we can do things like get a stable domain name or buy more hardware for the hosts and producers that will get this situation going along. Even better. The first clip we're going to play, this is from about almost a month ago, actually, but this really hasn't been covered that much. The class action lawsuit filed against the Army Corps of Engineers by hundreds of thousands or millions of people in South Louisiana and in Southeast Louisiana for building levees that spontaneously combusted in Category 1, Category 2 winds. That was thrown out of federal court last month because a judge said, you can't sue the government is God, and they're always right. And the lawyer, the attorney for that lawsuit, appeared on radio in New Orleans to explain the situation and talk about the appeal. And so here it is, for the record, Joe Bruno talking about the lawsuit.
Tommy in for Garland. Joe Bruno joins us right now, the lead counsel for the plaintiffs in their suit against the Corps of Engineers for the flooding that occurred as a result of failed levees during Katrina. Joe, how do we best tell a story of what's still viable and what's not, and where do we go from here?
Well, what's still viable are the claims against the Corps of Engineers that relate to the Mr. Go. The court long ago found that it's a navigation project, and therefore the 702C immunity, which was used to throw out our levy case, is not applicable. Now, not to say that, you know, the government's still not contending that that the case should be thrown out on that basis, but we are scheduled to go to trial in September of this year on that case.
So, is there any way they could get that one thrown out between now and September?
I don't think there's any way it can happen between now and September, to be candid with you. I think that they're hopeful that they can go to a higher court and have a higher court throw it out. But, you know,
just to break in here, Mr. Go, MRGO, that is a Mississippi River Gulf outlet, is a totally unnecessary canal that the Army Corps cut through southeast Louisiana near New Orleans relatively recently. It's also known as a hurricane highway. It's just an easy way for a large hurricane to destroy New Orleans. And, of course, it also crazy increase in coastal erosion by just cutting some shipping canal that was totally unneeded from the Gulf to the Mississippi River right through southeast Louisiana there. Continuing.
That's the nature of the business. The other side always wants to try to throw out your case.
And that's what happened with the 17th Street Canal and the
Yeah, except that I got to tell you, you know, if you've read the opinion, you will find that the court just excoriates the Corps.
Oh, yeah?
He says, well, you know, look, I mean, these people, it's outrageous that I have to apply this statute. Now, you know, in my humble opinion, I didn't think that he had to apply the statute because I suggested to him that the dredging of the 17th Street Canal was not a flood control project, but he found, as a matter of fact, that you know that had morphed into a flood control project when they put that concrete wall on top of the dredging project.
That would be the one that failed.
Well, the wall, you know, the concrete part didn't fail. It's the sheet piling that failed. The sheet piling was put there not by the Corps but by the levee board, and you know, our beef there was that the Corps gave them the approval to put it there when they knew all along that the bottom of the canal was a foot lower than the sheet pile. So it was a disaster in waiting.
So while we're talking about levee board and surge and water board, you still have suits pending against them, right?
We do. But the problem with the levee board is they only have $10 million of insurance, and you know, the law says that we can't seize any of the assets of the levee board, so we're pretty much locked in. The sewage and water board doesn't have a whole lot of assets either. So, you know, I mean, we'll pursue it, but I'm not really hopeful that we can get the kind of recovery we need for the people to break even, which is what we've, you know, we talked about before. I mean, we're not looking for a windfall. We're looking to fill a gap here.
And the bottom line is, however scathing Stanward Duvall's opinion was, it still doesn't allow you to proceed. So do you go to a higher court now, or what do you do?
Yes, you go to a higher court.
I saw you on TV last night, and you didn't look very optimistic.
I'm not optimistic at all with the higher court, but I mean, that doesn't mean I'm going to give up. You know, I think it's really about, it's about where we are politically. I hate to say that, but it's true. You know, you've got a Fifth Circuit that's extremely conservative, and that word, you know, God knows what that word means anymore. But it often means, you know, you
lose. That's a line of the day right there, Joe. God knows what conservative means today. That's,
yeah, well, I mean, you know, I listen to talk radio.
Oh, yeah.
I get very confused. You know,
sure, I am,
have
too.
To teach me. But the, you know, the point is that it really is, it's such a basic issue. I mean, you know, immunity shields bad conduct. I mean, the court made the point that you could be grossly negligent, willfully, intentionally negligent, and you get a card that says you get out of jail free. Is that what we want in our society today? Is that where we're going? You know, I mean, it's just really, we have to do some soul searching, and we, the Congress, has to do some soul searching and decide. And I've tried to make the point that this issue is not a New Orleans issue, it's not a Louisiana issue, it's a national issue, because,
you know,
the Corps of Engineers operates all over the country.
You know what's going on in Sacramento in that basin up there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people just don't seem to realize, you know, it's not about the quality of the engineering, because that's not what happened here. What happened was they decided that they were the arbiters of how to spend the money. They decided to use short sheet pile. They put the Orleans levee board, their back against the wall when they said, look, we don't care what you want. We're going to give you a gate at the outfall canals. And if you don't want the gate, fine. We'll give you the money for a gate, and you can do with the money what you want.
All right, hang on right there, Joe. The phone lines are filling up. If you dropped off a form, was it 95?
Form 95, yes.
Yeah, if you drove in that big, long line to the Corps of Engineers office on?
Well, there were two, March 1 and August 28.
No, but I meant the office is located on...
Oh, on Leakey. Yeah. How can we forget? On Leakey Avenue.
Leakey Avenue, right. Anyway, get those numbers to get involved if you got a question. If you're a member of that class about the suit. Joe Bruno, lead counsel. A lot of people working on a suit against the Corps of Engineers, as you heard by now, I'm sure. Two of the suits were thrown out, Joe, in terms of two of the suits were thrown out, or what? What happened?
There are many suits that were filed, and the court ordered that they all be consolidated into one lawsuit so that the issues could be resolved only once. So this is one lawsuit. It's the lawsuits, all the lawsuits that regard the London Avenue, Orleans Avenue, and 17th Street Canals. That's what's been resolved.
I know it's sheer speculation on your part, and with all due respect to U.S. District Judge Stanward Duvall, you know, it's nice to say that his hands are tied, that there's nothing we can do, that that's the way the law reads, and that's the way he has to apply it. But in your opinion, this is strictly your opinion, because I don't think you have any facts to back this up, What part does precedent play in this and the problems that the Corps of Engineers are having all over the country, north of Reno, Nevada? A levee broke and caused some problems. That was not a Corps of Engineer levee. Let me correct myself on that. But Sacramento, and I forgot the name of the valley, they have a huge problem, and the ramifications of this could flood Sacramento, flood the Sacramento airport, which is the capital of California, and also potentially contaminate the water supply for the entire state. So I guess what I'm asking you is, you know, is the court, you think, concerned about protecting the country from liability, looking down the road?
No. I have to say, you know, this is a 42-page opinion.
Okay.
I don't think he was concerned at all about protecting anybody. I think he was concerned about following the law.
Okay.
I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that the law was there. Yeah, I knew it was there. I didn't believe and do not believe today that the law is applicable to the facts of this case, and it's why I brought the suit. I mean, I know that a lot of people have criticized that, but I believe and will always believe it is something that had to be done. It's something that had to be done because what the court did was wrong, and until now, until this lawsuit, really has not been much of a spotlight put on their activities. I mean, they haven't answered a single question. They haven't been subjected to any evaluation or investigation by the Congress. I mean, you know, but for the lawsuit, this would not be on anybody's mind at all. So I think the upshot and the import of this decision is Judge Duvall is saying, look, there's something wrong with this picture. These people did wrong, and yeah, this statute is what it is. And there's a problem here.
And politically,
I'm hopeful that the Fifth Circuit or the Congress will act.
Politically, you mentioned earlier, you don't know, half jokingly, you don't know what a conservative is anymore. And if we're going to rail against activist judges, then you got to take your medicine. You understand what I'm saying?
I don't know what all that foolishness means. All I know is that, you know, what we do is. We do our best.
Right.
You know?
If you're going to rail against activist judges interpreting the law to make the law rather than just applying it, well, then you got to take your medicine if it doesn't go your way as well. I'm not talking to you specifically.
And I respect that. And you're absolutely correct.
Philosophically,
that,
you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's why I say I'm tired of all this. You know, the talk is cheap.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people out in this community who actually do a job, who actually work, who actually are suffering, who actually, you know, have houses that are not repaired. You know, we deal in that reality. You deal in that reality. You listen to these people every day of your life. You know, you respond to that. And that's all we can do. You know, we do our best.
Yep.
And, you know, we have a situation here. I don't care what anybody says. It's wrong. It's a wrong situation.
And a judge acknowledged that. He just said he didn't have, as I understand it, the legal remedy to apply to that as it stands now.
Right. And does that mean you just sit down, lay down, let it happen? No. It means you try to do something. You try to do your best. We have the resources of this law firm. We have, you know, the courts are available to us to raise these issues, and that's what they're for.
Hi, Joe in Metairie. Good afternoon. You're on with Joe Bruno.
Yeah, Mr. Bruno.
Yes, sir.
First of all, let me ask you, what month and date, day of the month in 1928 was this law officially passed?
Oh man, you're testing me.
Why, Joe? We're running late on time. Why is it?
1928. It was in
1928.
Yeah,
this law goes on the books, which protects the United States government from lawsuits that could effectively put it out of business the following year in 1929. When you had the stock market crash at the beginning of the Great Depression.
No, that's not true. You see, that's the folly of that argument. This only applies to flood control projects. If you slip and fall on the steps of the courthouse, you can sue them.
That's
my point, man. It makes no sense.
Again, if you're going to have a law, right? If you're going to apply the law equally,
yeah. I mean, you know, if you get hit by a mailman, you sue the government. If you, you know, I mean, the point I'm trying to
see.
Make
wait,
is,
Joe. I don't think a lot of people realize that the government is not unsuable. I know that's not a legal term.
Well,
but there are instances under which you can sue the government,
well,
right?
In fact, you can sue the government for just about anything
except this.
Flood control.
Incredible. Hang on, Joe. We're coming right back. If you want to talk to Joe Bruno about the status of the suits against the Corps of Engineers, we resume our conversation with Joe Bruno. Tony from the West Bank, good afternoon. You're on with Mr. Bruno.
Yeah, how you doing there, Tommy?
Good.
And I have a question and a comment to make with the attorney, Mr. Bruno, you have on.
Okay.
I think that, you know, it was a good thing that he got together and got some clients aboard and you know, is actually trying to, you know, hold the government liable. I mean, is you know, attorneys are in it for the money, but it's the right thing to do, too. I mean, every business is in it to make money.
But wait, Tony, in all fairness, I mean, they got expenses, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, they got to pay a roll of meat as well.
My point is, I want to ask Mr. Bruno, the judge that declined for the lawsuit at this point to proceed, was that a federal judge or was that a state judge?
Federal judge.
So, okay, then my next point is, I think that, and hopefully, you know, I live in Jefferson Parish, but I do have relatives that their homes were flooded in Orleans Parish, and I think that the government should be held liable. I mean, but again, they say that we live in the United States, we have the best system in the world, but sometimes, as a citizen of Louisiana and born in the United States, sometimes I wonder if we do have the right system.
When you say right system, you mean government in general, not flood control.
Well, yeah, I mean the court system, because
okay.
I look at it like this. This federal judge that sat down and looked at the evidence and looked at the laws that were on the books, who does he work for? He works for the government. His check comes from the U.S. government. So who do you think, not Einstein, wasn't dropped off a milk truck yesterday or the banana cart, but I tell you what, it seems like the attorney, Mr. Bruno, hopefully they'll come out and prevail and win, and some justice will be served here for the people of Orleans Parish. But it just seems like the judge is going to side with the government because that's who he works for, just like U.S. attorneys appointed by the president, just like people that sit on the Supreme Court. They're appointed by the president. Just like when we get a new president, he's probably going to, you know, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, he's going to put some of his party in there. So
right. Well, hang on, Tony. Let's see what Joe has to say about that. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, it's interesting that you make the point because, you know, on face value, that would seem to make sense. But the people who wrote the Constitution, frankly, were smarter than you think because these federal judges are appointed for life and they can't be removed. And so it's all about the motivation. You're right. Yeah, they get their salary from the United States government, but they can't be removed. And the idea about not removing them was to allow them to apply the law appropriately and fairly. So what you would hope is that a president, be he a Republican or a Democrat, would choose somebody who's got brain in his head or her head and is going to apply the law fairly. And there's nothing that anybody can do to hurt them, to persuade them to do something that they rather not do. So, I mean, the motivation that you're talking about is the motivation that one would have if you were employed by somebody who could say to you the next day, hey, man, I'm going to fire you unless you do what I tell you to do.
Yeah, I think
you can't
Tony
do
was,
that with a federal judge.
I think he was jumbling up a lot of things. If there's a vacancy, the president gets to appoint the judge, or in the case of a U.S. attorney, they serve at the pleasure of a president, but the judgeship is completely different.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's why you had the problem with the U.S. attorneys, because they did fire them. When these prosecutors weren't doing what Bush wanted them to do, he fired them. I mean, that's a very valid point, but you can't fire a federal judge. So you would hope that they're applying the law fairly.
Val in Lakeview, good afternoon. You're on with Mr. Bruno. Quickly, please.
Hi, Mr. Bruno. Val Cupid of Lakeview Civic Improvement Association. I'm not calling on behalf of Dale. I'm calling on behalf. I lost two houses in Lakeview that were bought and paid for. I thoroughly agree with you. Keep fighting. This was not a flood control project, the 17th Street Canal. Anyway, what I'd like to ask you is, if this wall fell during, let's say, a regular rainstorm, not a hurricane, would the outcome be different?
Or you know what, Val? Let's take it a step further. Say the concrete failed, or for whatever reason, right? That's what you're saying?
Right.
Okay, what about that, Joe?
On a regular weekday with no storm.
Well, that's an excellent point. And based upon the ruling by the judge, the answer would be the ruling would be the same, because it's the nature of once you label it a flood control project, it's over. If, for example, if you labeled it a navigation project, we could sue them. So it's not how the water got in, it's whether or not it's a federal flood control project that rules the day.
So see,
and that's why I say it makes no sense.
And along those lines, thank you, Val, for the call, along those lines, that's got to bode well for your suit concerning the Mr. Go.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, we're pressing ahead there. We're doing what we can. I'm wondering if Val would tell us, did the insurance cover her loss? Because, you know, we have people out there who are accusing us of money grubbing or taking things that we don't belong. I mean, I don't know if she's still on.
No, she's not. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. It's just horrendous. I've read these blogs on the NOLA.com.
Yeah.
And I mean, some of the stuff these people are spewing is just absolutely embarrassing.
Yeah, and I'll bet you a lot of them didn't lose a thing. That's the other thing. And I always like to, pardon the cliche, whatever, voir dire people and ask them, did you lose a house? Because if you don't have a horse in the race, it's easy to be a lot more, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I look at it a different way. Yeah, I mean, you know, Andrew,
and poor Val, I'm sorry for your loss for losing two houses. That's terrible. We'll pause for a moment, come back, wrap it up with Joe Bruno. I'm Tommy in for Garland on Big 870 WWL. A couple of minutes left on the Big 870 WWL. Joe Bruno, our guest. Let's try to squeeze in another call. Chris in Metairie, good afternoon. You're on with Joe.
Hey, how you doing, Joe?
Hey, man, how are you?
Pretty good. I just want to know, and look, I'm with you on the federal government being on the hook, but what about all these millions of dollars we've been spending towards these levee boards who was supposed to be watchdog and all this stuff, who wasted millions of dollars in, like, I think there was three projects out of, like, 14, 15 projects that were non-levee related? How come they're not being sued?
They are being sued.
I didn't know.
But okay. they only have 10.
Of course they're being sued. The problem, of course, is that the law will not permit us to seize their assets. They do have an insurance policy. It's only a $10 million policy. And as I think I told Tommy before, they want to put that money up. But the United States government has said to them, if you do that, we're going to sue you too. So, I mean, it's beyond crazy. Yeah, but your point's well taken. Of course they have some responsibility. And we had hoped, you know, that one day we would be able to measure that responsibility against the responsibility of the Corps of Engineers. Because, you know, as I said, the levee board probably has some fault, but the Corps really backed them into a corner when you start reading these facts. It's just amazing.
All right, Marshall from Metairie, you're going to be the last caller for Joe. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to sense if Fred seems to feel the water coming in, the Mr. Go is responsible, and the Mr. Go flooded the
St. Bernard and Lower Nine.
And Upper Nine.
And the Upper Nine. And once the water gets into the Upper Nine, it's going to run through the whole city.
What about that, Joe? That's a good point. What about that?
Well, except that we hired, it is a good point, and it's exactly why I hired experts from the Netherlands to do a computer model to show where the water went. And what we found was that the Metairie Ridge and the Esplanade Ridge effectively blocked that water. So we've included the area that would be to the east of the Esplanade Ridge and south of the Gentilly Ridge in our Mr. Go lawsuit.
Joe, just a couple of seconds. Timeline, when will we know about the appeal?
Well, the judge has to certify it before it gets appealed because it's not a final judgment yet. So it'll take a couple of months before we kind of see where that all goes.
Thank you, Joe.
Pretty interesting interview right there. And interesting point made at the end. It seems like with the Mr. Go litigation, you still got Eastern New Orleans as plaintiffs. And so that's pretty interesting. The Ninth Ward in Eastern New Orleans, still mostly black areas of New Orleans, actually. And St. Bernard, of course, which is a white parish. We're going to listen to Jeff Hill. This is actually, I never heard this, but Jeff Hill, the great Canadian interviewer, back in October, called someone from NIST, the National Institute of Science and Technology. And he had some questions for him. So let's check that out.
Okay. Hello?
Hi, Bill?
Yeah.
Hi. Sorry to bother you. This is Jeff again, the guy that was talking to you last week. I received your email, and I was just wondering, you had said it was an outside contractor that it did the calculations and everything?
Well, on the airplane flight path, yeah.
You wouldn't happen to know who he was?
No, I do know who he was, but I'm not sure. I suspect you can find out from the report.
Oh, it'd be in the report somewhere?
I think so.
So it's not somebody that works for NIST or anything? It's just like an outside contractor?
Well, hired to do the stuff. They did the airplane impact analysis for us.
Was it like, was he with a company or something, or that might be in the report? Or?
Yeah, Raf Fahim. He didn't work with me. He actually worked with Fahim.
Well, he did. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I know who it was, obviously, but I'm not. He's either a co-author, or probably shouldn't let you know who he is, just because of the type of work he does.
Oh yeah, so it's not like something I could just find, like.
Like I said, he's either in the report or Raf Fahim. I just don't feel comfortable with him.
Okay.
Whatever, but
okay. Well, I understand.
Author, I'm just not sure. Let me check real fast.
All right.
I don't know why you need to talk to him because the answer is going to be everything he used came through me.
So basically, that's just he just triangulated the position out of like just by looking at the video, then.
Yeah, I mean that's what he does for a living. He tracks something, and add from videos. And that he applied that expertise to the airplane. Apparently, the analysis of the aircraft impacts from that is basically from that company. A whole bunch of names on there. I don't see the fellow actually. I don't know. Did you go look up the picture by Carmen Taylor that I mentioned?
Yeah, I've seen hers too. Yeah.
They were clearly shot from the same point. And I've talked to Carmen, and I know where she was, and she was in Battery Park.
She was just, like, on the ground in Battery Park?
She claims in this news report I was telling you about that she was on the ferry, presumably near shore, presumably on shore. But, yeah, if you look at where the trees are, too, they have to be on that other side of that park. I don't know if you looked at the overhead videos. Overhead, there's a bunch of overhead shots that you can pick up both before and after the event on September 11th. And I looked at those two the other day, and I could see the two buildings. And if you draw a line, you're pretty damn close to where I told you.
Yeah, like she had, I guess Carmen Taylor had said that she was waiting to board the ferry when she had taken the pictures.
That's what she said in her interview paper. Now, she moved around, too. I was noticing that yesterday as well. I was looking at some of her photographs. And she was moving around as well during that time. But they're all shooting over top of trees, and a large number of trees, and the only place that could be true is on the other side of that, is right on the edge of the water at that park, in Battery Park. So yeah. I don't know where you guys are ending up lining up, but if you just draw those lines on the buildings, you got to be pretty close to where I told you.
Because the funny, like, the thing was, is when she says she's waiting to board the ferry's already left when the second impact occurred.
I don't know which ferry you're talking about. She could have been on the water, too. If she was, the ferry was going pretty much straight line to where it was heading. And it's also possible this guy could have been with her, but it's not very far off. Couldn't be very far off.
No, yeah, it's just there was just a big discrepancy with people trying to go there and get the same shot.
That's interesting. You know, I'd like to see what you did, but I don't need to. But can't be that far off. It's just a matter of getting those two buildings lined together.
Yeah. And just, like, the fact that Mr. Hezekani won't say anything is just, it's peculiar. Like, a lot of people seem to think that the video's fake. Because if you look at the video...
Within hours, how could it be fake?
Well, if you look at the video of the plane going in, it's physically impossible for the plane to just go into the building like that. It doesn't break, it doesn't, crumble or anything. It just kind of goes in, and even when you watch the video in slow motion, you see the wings going in, and the building where the wings go in are still intact until after it goes in. It's like all the whole plane's kind of like already in there, and there's nothing wrong with the building, and like as soon as the plane would hit the building, there should be an explosion. The wings should break, the tail section should be breaking or crumpling or something, and it just kind of seamlessly melds into the building.
I don't disagree with what you're saying. I looked at the same stuff. I've seen exactly the same thing in 15 other videos. I don't see how they all could fake it. I guess that would be my only...
Yeah, well, that's a big question a lot of people have, but then when you start to look at the people that...
Canadian one, it shows exactly the same thing.
Yeah, but all these people have this weird thing in common where they're all, like, involved with digital manipulation in their jobs and everything.
Okay. See, it sounds like you're you're one of the conspiracy people, and that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. You guys are welcome to take a look at this stuff, but it's a, you know, go through and look at what's in the in our reports. There's information in there about the size of the hole that was poked in the building compared to the aircraft size. I've looked at all those videos. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people, and including a lot of the news people that were involved in this stuff and how they upload things and where things come from.
Mm-hmm.
And if they did it ahead of time, then they did a pretty good job of figuring out where the thing was going to hit, put it that way. And if they did it afterwards, I just don't think that's feasible. I don't know how many we had. I think we had 27 or something, ultimately, was showing the airplane coming in. A number of photographs. Carmen Taylor's photograph is totally consistent with the video as well.
Yeah, that would be like another thing is how the camera that she had, how would she be able to get a picture of the plane that clear going over 500 miles an hour? It's just like, I don't know. She'd have to be a pretty good...
A lot of people got, I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there. And all I can say to you is I've seen no, I mean, I've looked at it pretty hard. I've seen no indication of anything being fabricated. That's all I can say.
Yeah. It just, I guess, yeah, there's just some strange anomalies that just are questionable, but I don't know. I guess maybe one day we'll know the answer.
I don't think you ever will, just because it was, I firmly believe that none of them was staged. And staged, it would just be an incredible, pick the right spot on the building, have something crash into it, and as many videos as there are, you're really pushing to try to get... Now, there were people in New Jersey, there were people in Brooklyn, there were people in Queens, and they all aren't professionals, by the way.
Well, true, yeah, but there's also, like, when you look at some of the videos, the planes are coming in at different angles than other videos and stuff, like, it just...
A lot of parallax effects, but, you know, the one shot from below, the one shot off the building, all these pictures are in our report from all these different directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, the guy who did the analysis of the aircraft trajectory was a professional.
Yeah.
And, there were no indications of things that he said that would line up and give the right answer. So, I don't have any problem with it. I know you guys are still trying to figure out what you're seeing, and I don't blame you, because I looked at it too, and to me, it's still amazing that the building just ate the plane. It's amazing that the fires didn't start initially when it first went through. You guys are correct about that. Obviously, the fuel got pretty deep into the building before there was the ignition source. And, it's miraculous when you look at it. Both planes were the same way, and I still feel the same way. But the analysis we did on aircraft impact said that if you had fuel tanks that were fully loaded, that's exactly what you might expect to see.
Yeah.
Like I said, I can't tell you any more about that, but that's exactly. I don't find it to be inconsistent. I've probably looked at it just as far as you guys have.
You've, like, slowed it down and everything? And
oh, yeah.
Step by step.
I measured the plane speeds by doing frame-by-frame analysis. I did a whole range of things. All that stuff described in various places. I'm not telling you anything that's not publicly available.
No, I understand, yeah. Okay, well, like I said, thank you very much for the time that you took to talk to me. And
okay, good luck
email.
With what you're trying to do.
Okay, you take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
And there you have it. That was Jeff Hill and the guy from this, Bill Pitts, back in October. Who knows where that guy's head is? I mean, you're right. It is fucking amazing that a little aluminum airplane disappeared into a steel building. It's just crazy. So anyway, tonight's program is brought to you by Monty Python's Holy Ale. It's tempered over burning witches. You can get 1 pint and 0.9 fluid ounce size, and it's from the Black Sheep Brewery in Masham, Yorkshire. blacksheep.co.uk. So check that out. It's pretty good. Abita beer is also a sponsor tonight. Some action in the chat room. Someone pointed out that the federal courts are also fucking over the people of South Louisiana and Gulf Coast vis-a-vis the insurance companies. There's this whole thing where the insurance companies, it's really, they're not fucking over Mississippi people nearly as much. They are fucking over people in Louisiana because they're saying that, well, you know, you have hurricane coverage, you don't have flood coverage, or you only have so much flood coverage, or the federal government takes care of flood coverage. But the point is, that's flood coverage is for normal things like when a river overflows, not when a hurricane damages a flood wall, because it wasn't flooding so much as it was wind. It's very complicated. But anyway, so the people in Mississippi got covered because the water pushed the wind pushed the water, so they got much bigger payouts. But anyway, and the Supreme Court has refused to hear that case. So there you have it. Moving on, we do have, well, we're going to test a new phone system that everybody's been scrambling for by calling Congressman Dr. Ron Paul. He wanted to tell us about the Texas Transport Corridor.
Hello, this is Ron Paul with your weekly update for February 5th. One major concern I discussed a few weeks ago regarding the Trans-Texas Corridor is where the land will come from. Another concern is where the money will come from. Official government websites for the TTC assure that public-private partnerships will shield the taxpayer from bearing too much of the cost of earth. But a careful reading shows the door is definitely open to public funding sources, while at the same time there's no doubt the intention to charge tolls on the road. Taxpayers already pay for their transportation system through hefty gasoline taxes, vehicle registration fees, and other fees. They have every right to expect the roads they have already paid for to be properly maintained and toll-free. However, private foreign corporations have flocked to this country eager to participate in toll collection on our poorly managed toll roads, and they can make a lot of money doing so. Taking over the management and maintenance of an existing toll road is one thing. Converting taxpayer-built roads into cash cows for big corporations is quite another. Using eminent domain to take privately owned land and taxpayer funding to build a highway that is designed to bring in private revenue is nothing short of highway robbery. Centra Zachary, a private Spanish firm, is poised to make billions from TTC tolls. Yet my fear is that as planning progresses, more and more public burden will creep into the process and more profit will be pledged to the private corporation. The cost will be socialized and the profits will be privatized. And to add insult to injury, private lands will be taken for this road, which will be, for all intents and purposes, a private business. The government should not use the power of eminent domain to seize and redistribute land for the benefit of a private company. This is wrong and unconstitutional. Centra Zachary should negotiate with each individual landowner and go through the normal private land acquisition process to start its new business. If mutual agreements can be reached, fine. If not, government force is not appropriate. Our government should protect property rights, not facilitate theft. Toll roads should not be paid for with taxpayers' dollars or even bond funding that pledge future tax dollars. Taxpayers should not have to pay additional fees for something they have already paid for. Eminent domain should be absolutely not used for private businesses. This private-public partnership has all the makings of the worst of both worlds. I am doing my part at the federal level in Congress to limit the damage to the taxpayer. I introduced a bill that prohibits the use of federal funding for any part of the TTC, and I will continue to push for this bill and other bills protecting property rights, taxpayers' rights, and our national sovereignty. The government should not fund and enforce private efforts like this and thumb their nose at landowners and taxpayers. Thanks for calling this update.
And there you go. Congressman Dr. Ron Paul. And now, some music from the Sickabillies. This is called Non-Believers and the Truth Seekers.
Within the earth where prophets pass, they do their vital breathing there. A voice born and seldom never heard. Why'd you laugh? Is a fool who's much too busy breathing, scared of monsters at all? It doesn't really matter to him. Short, smart, dumb, or tall. Somewhere near the end, you'll hear the tortured screams of men. Guilty from the fall of an angry ceiling, the seventh trumpet calls the end. Repent your ways at the end of the day, or enter the gates as a wounded beast, crawling to save her young, crawling to save her young, crawling to save her young. Non-believers and truth seekers are the last army standing. The last army standing on the last war till no more. I see that all instead. You keep the scene inside your head. Never seen, never heard, never said, never seen, never heard, never said.
Let's listen in to Mark Lane, the lawyer and author of Rush to Judgment, appearing on William F. Buckley's television program Firing Line on December 1st, 1966. This is rather interesting. I think he does an able job of dissecting the CIA agent William F. Buckley, former Mexico City station chief. We also have some really awesome audio of Dick Gregory going nuts, talking about the white man poisoning the black man's malt liquor. That's pretty awesome. So stay tuned for that.
How come if you're the man who has changed history, these forces haven't bumped you off, Mr. Lane?
Well, I think, fortunately, we haven't come to that. I would like to comment, if I may, upon portions of your introduction. It is not just liberals and leftists who cannot accept the Warren Commission report. Of course, I think the very best review and most favorable review, which my book received, was in your publication, The National Review.
I'm talking about your pre-Kennedy reputation, by way of background.
Before the assassination.
Yes, sir.
When I was elected to the...
There was assassination, wasn't
there? Yes, when I was elected, no question about that. When I was elected to the state legislature with the endorsement and support of President Kennedy, that's the left-liberal approach you're talking about. In terms of the assassination, though, in terms of the Warren report, of course, the Lou Harris poll shows now that two-thirds of the American people indicate that they cannot accept its conclusions. So I think that it's not even an unpopular cause with which I'm associated any longer. And regarding the earlier comments you made, I think the best way to respond to them is probably with the opening line of your book, which I'm afraid I may butcher because I'll just paraphrase it, but it was something like, when you are a controversialist, you can either go mad or ignore genuinely unjust criticism, and I prefer, as you do, the latter course.
Well, yeah, I hope there hasn't been any genuinely unjust criticism yet on this show. It is, I think, a matter of some importance as far as the American thinking community is concerned to investigate a motive, to investigate one's general attitude toward the events in Dallas. For instance, Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times, who has himself been accused of being much too liberal. Has said that Mr. McLean, quote, is a New York attorney who has made a career of insinuating that Mr. Kennedy was the victim of a right-wing plot.
Now, what I mean by unjust criticism is to take that early comment, which he wrote when he did the introduction to Warren Report, and to ignore his present statement, where he states now, although the New York Times will not tell you this, although he's the associate managing editor, in a recent review in The Progressive, he's indicated that he finds much substance in my charges, and in a recent Canadian Broadcasting Company broadcast, he said if he were asked again, he would not do the introduction to the Warren Report because he doesn't have sufficient confidence in it.
Well, that I was not aware of. What I'm trying to see, simply to place into perspective, is where you figure in terms of the general criticism of the report. Would this be fair or not fair to say, Mr. Lane, since we're going to strike out for justice?
Excellent.
That certain people, ever since the assassination, both on the left and on the right, have been highly dissatisfied by the findings of the Warren Commission. Highly dissatisfied because it didn't fit their ideological predisposition. Certain members of the right, for instance, are terribly anxious to find out that somebody in the Kremlin pushed a button and that Oswald was immediately energized, raised his rifle, and pulled the trigger. You consider this naive, I assume. But by the same token, we have, for instance, Professor H. Stuart Hughes, shortly after the assassination, writing in the Nation magazine, what most of us at first thought was that the crime had been committed by a Southern racist. Indeed, if we look deeply into our souls, I think many of us will recognize that we were disappointed to learn that such was not the case. Now,
I think it's true.
It
those on the right,
yeah,
who would like to believe that those on the left were involved in a conspiratorial way,
yes,
and those on the left have the same feeling about those on the right.
Yes, but your reputation has been as a left liberal within the spectrum of New York politics, so the people who first look into your association with this particular venture might unjustly, I admit, I think of you as somebody who is trying to rescue Oswald as the putative killer.
But since I don't
Oswald was book, communist.
Well, since I don't even say in my book that Oswald was innocent, the first one cannot really
give
me of that motive.
Yes, the this is the effect of your book, isn't it?
No, I think my book shows quite conclusively the shot came from at least two directions, and at the law, a conspiracy is nothing more, of course, than two or more persons acting in concert to effect an illegal end. So the book says there was a conspiracy to kill the president.
Both our host and our guest are speaking softly so far, but I'm sure a few big sticks will be raised before the end of this hour.
Is it or is it not fair then to say that your book does not go further than to say that the Warren Commission didn't take all the evidence into account, but by no means go so far as to say that Oswald is exonerated on the basis of your reading of the findings?
Well, it goes beyond, I think, the former, and not quite as far as the latter. I think the book states quite clearly that the Warren Report is a fraudulent document, not merely that they did not take sufficient evidence into consideration, but they distorted evidence, they misused evidence, and what's worse, I think they oversimplified evidence.
Well, let me ask you then this, so I can understand you completely. Assuming for impossibility that Oswald would rise up from the dead, come up here and say, Mr. Lane, I did fire the fatal shot, this would not invalidate your book in any way, would it?
Well, I don't think he could have fired the fatal shot because that shot because the shot came from the right front.
But if he said I fired one of the shots.
Yes, that certainly is a possibility. The mere fact that the Warren Commission was totally unable to prove that doesn't mean that it's not true.
Now, is it or is it not, would you not agree that even though this is a wild, desperate crime, pretty much in the category of the criminal who killed McKinley, even though we are prepared to say that there is no reason to assume that Oswald got orders from the communist apparatus, that nevertheless there was a very considerable record of Oswald's sympathy with the communists, which for some reason isn't stressed in your book. I say some reason, you might have simply thought it methodologically irrelevant.
I think that the political commitments of those who, in terms of the evidence, are proven to be nothing more than spectators, I think that's quite irrelevant to a determination as to where the shot came from.
Yeah, we're not rushing up to say that Oswald was a spectator. Well, yeah, I thought that you said, but it would not surprise you if, in fact, you put one of the...
I think it would not invalidate my book. It would surprise me because I think there's no evidence to show that. I take really the same position Alfredo Scobie, one of the lawyers for the Warren Commission, takes. And that is, had Oswald lived, he could not have been proven guilty had he faced trial based upon the evidence the commission was able to secure.
And of course, Warren says that he was a practicing district attorney for 10 or 12 years and he could have gotten a conviction in 48 hours with the evidence.
Yes,
you simply disagree with him professionally.
That's nonsense. It would take longer than that to pick a jury.
Do you think Warren should be impeached?
I don't think he should be impeached. I think his report should be impeached.
Well, but we certainly don't want to. We certainly don't want the incompetent chief justices around.
Well, we're used to those. We've had them for many years.
But this is the first one you would not impeach.
No, I would not impeach any of them. I don't know of any of the chief justices who should be impeached.
But you would think that...
I think mere incompetence is not the reason to disqualify a judge. We'd have an empty bench.
Yeah. So you take a lot of severe view about the competence of Supreme Court justices. So it was, not I.
Oh.
Yeah. I guess you want to retreat from your position. Well,
that goes back really to your early position. My position is not...
Well, sure, Mr. Warren, since you most specifically accuse him of presiding over a whitewash or a kangaroo court or whatever you want to talk about. Now, is it or is it not fair then to say that your book does not go further than to say that the Warren Commission didn't take all of the evidence into account, but by no means goes so far as to say that Oswald is exonerated on the basis of your reading of the findings?
Well, it goes beyond, I think, the former and not quite as far as the latter. I think the book states quite clearly that the Warren Report is a fraudulent document. Not merely that they did not take sufficient evidence into consideration, but they distorted evidence, they misused evidence, and what's worse, I think they oversimplified evidence.
Well, let me ask you then this, so I can understand you completely. Assuming, for impossibility, that Oswald would arise up from the dead, come up here and say, Mr. Lane, I did fire the fatal shot. This would not invalidate your book in any way, would it?
Well, I don't think he could have fired the fatal shot because that shot because the shot came from the right front.
But if you said I fired one of the shots.
Yes, that certainly is a possibility. The mere fact that the Warren Commission was totally unable to prove that doesn't mean that it's not true. Yeah.
Now, would you not agree that even though this was a wild, desperate crime, pretty much in the category of the criminal who killed McKinley, even though we are prepared to say that there is no reason to assume that Oswald got orders from the communist apparatus, but nevertheless there was a very considerable record of Oswald's sympathy with the communists, which for some reason isn't stressed in your book. I take some reason. You might have simply thought it methodologically irrelevant.
I think that the political commitments of those who, in terms of the evidence, are proven to be nothing more than spectators, I think that's quite irrelevant to a determination as to where the shot came from.
Yeah, we're not rushing up to say that Oswald was a spectator. Well, yeah, I thought that you said, but it would not surprise you if, in fact, you pulled one of the...
Would not invalidate my book. It would surprise me because I think there's no evidence to show that. I take really the same position Alfredo Scobie, one of the lawyers for the Warren Commission, takes. And that is, had Oswald lived, he could not have been proven guilty had he faced trial based upon the evidence the commission was able to secure.
And of course, Warren says that he was a practicing district attorney for 10 or 12 years and he could have gotten a conviction in 48 hours with the evidence.
Yes,
you disagree with him professionally.
That's nonsense. It would take longer than that to pick a jury.
Do you think Warren should be impeached?
I don't think he should be impeached. I think his report should be impeached.
Well, but we certainly don't want to. Because you don't want incompetent chief justices around.
Well, we're used to those. We've had them for many years.
But this is the first one you would not impeach.
No, I would not impeach any of them. I don't know of any of the chief justices who should be impeached.
But you would think that...
I think hearing comments is not the reason to disqualify a judge. We'd have an empty bench.
Yeah, yeah. So you take a lot of severe view about the competence of Supreme Court justices. So do I, not I.
Oh.
Yeah. I guess you want to retreat from your position. Well,
that goes back really to your early position. My position is not arrived at either by my political view or your political view. I think that the integrity of my book depends not upon my own political bias, and of course I have several of them, many of them, but upon the 5,000 citations and references to the Warren Commission's own evidence, which marked the book from the beginning to the end. Either they're in context or they're not, either they're accurate or not. I suggest that they're accurate, and they've not yet been proven by any of the 2,000 reviewers to be inaccurate or out of context so far.
Well, now, you just finished quoting a lawyer, Mr. Scobie, I haven't heard about. Suppose I quote one that maybe you never heard about.
All right.
He's with the UCLA Law School.
Oh, yes, I know.
And he says, Lane misstated or distorted the record in 15 instances. Lane has threatened to sue. He hasn't. Is that just because you're otherwise engaged, or what?
I am going to sue Wesley Liebler for libel, no question about it. He's clearly pathologically committed to the commission's case. It's an unfortunate matter, but it's a personal matter, and he has to deal with that with those in another discipline.
How would you feel about people who said the reverse about you, that you're pathologically committed to its opposite?
I would say they're in error.
Uh-huh.
That's that unjust criticism that you made reference to in your first sentence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you say that there really isn't sufficient evidence to incriminate Oswald, is it not true that it is conceded the gun was sent to Oswald? It is conceded.
It's conceded by the Warren Commission, yes.
In the course of approaching the problem the way you did, aren't you really asking the question, what kind of investigation is absolutely necessary to establish that which is commonly regarded as a certitude? For instance, suppose one would decide at this moment to convene a commission to establish the innocence of Dreyfus. It might in fact be hard to do, but isn't the certitude of the innocence of Dreyfus a part of your sort of natural equipment? Aren't you willing to come to historical terms with that data?
Well, the French government, which originally said he was guilty, reversed itself after Esterhazy. I confess that he was guilty.
There are a lot of Marguerites around, you know, who make the same objections to the French government's action in the case of Dreyfus as you were making.
But the man who was guilty confessed and said that Dreyfus was in no way involved.
Well, you wouldn't have had that. That could have taken half a chapter to have handled a confession by Oswald.
No, not Dreyfus.
You said all kinds of things about witnesses.
Are you suggesting that Dreyfus was guilty?
No, I'm simply saying that the same, as much of the case can be made for the innocence of Dreyfus as for the innocence of Oswald.
And they make both of them.
Which are highly ingenious. But let me put it another way. If you're willing to believe, I think, that either a combination of ruthlessness or some combination of ruthlessness, cynicism, and sloth permitted J. Edgar Hoover and Earl Warren and seven or eight distinguished Americans appointed by the president with the tacit acquiescence of Robert Kennedy and a bunch of hardworking professional lawyers and investigators to come up with a verdict that was palpably indefensible. Then, if you're willing to set that assumption, it becomes simply a matter of legal ingenuity, and you're extremely ingenious to contrive an extremely interesting case to go ahead and prove your assumptions. So methodologically, aren't you as much at error?
Well, I think without that approach, you say there is no truth. We can never discover what has ever happened. I don't believe that that's so. I think we can. I think there are mechanisms developed so that we can. I think the American judicial system is a sound one. Cross-examination, open and public hearings, the right to counsel for the accused. I think these things tend to assist the determination of the truth.
Because we know about not a lot of innocent people who are convicted and guilty people who are...
How many innocent people would have been convicted if they didn't have those protections? The fact is the Warren Commission made none of those protections available. Do you know what they did? They took testimony. They've never published the transcripts of the testimony. That's locked up by order of your president for 75 years.
Yours too, right?
Yes.
You voted for him.
No, I did not vote for him, as a matter of fact. Until September 2039 is when we can, the time has passed until we can examine that. What the commission did was to publish
a printed version, but in Volume 1 of the report, the Commission states that it reserved the right to edit the testimony, to edit the transcript, to improve the accuracy and the clarity of the witness's statement. Doesn't that frighten you a little bit about that power?
No more so than that I don't have access to the notes that went into your book. I'm sure that every time you bumped into a witness who said, yes, Mr. Lane, I saw him and he was Oswald, he very likely didn't figure prominently in your book. I gather that the burden of your charge is that evidence that the Warren Committee secreted away, the loose notes, the notebooks and so on, were it publicly accessible, tend to undermine the Warren Commission's case. Otherwise, would it not simply be a perfectly matter-of-fact and conventional way of exercising editorial judgment? For instance, I find it impossible to read everything that Ruby said in his own interview with the Warren Commission investigators simply on the grounds of its inherent unintelligibility. Now, don't they have some sort of a right to exercise editorial judgment, assuming that we trust their integrity?
I'm surprised you asked that question, because you know that can never be done in a trial, in any court. No judge edits the testimony and then presents it to the jury or to the public. And in this our most important case, the jury was the American people, I think. And we have the right to look at the unintelligible statements made by Mr. Ruby and the unintelligible questions asked by Chief Justice Warren as well. I think that's one of our basic rights in a democratic society, which you have, right?
Yes. Well, I think it may be a basic right, which is in and of itself an interesting question. It's not necessarily an interesting question to ask whether or not one must suppose from the fact that certain of the evidence, let's say CIA reports from Havana to Washington, it's not necessarily an interesting question to ask whether or not access to those is indispensable to the making of a responsible judgment.
Oh, I don't think that secret material of that nature should be revealed, but that's not the problem. We have the photographs and the x-rays of the president's body. It would resolve the collateral question in the case very likely, the origin of the shots. Now, President Johnson was asked at a recent press conference by Mr. Spivak why it was that the Warren Commission never examined those invaluable documents, and why no non-governmental person can now look at them. And President Johnson replied that they were available to the commission. I think that didn't answer the question, the first portion. And secondly, he said, we wouldn't want them paraded around every sewing circle in America. Well, no one really suggested that. I think that competent pathologists should have examined these invaluable documents and rendered an opinion to the commission. And today, independent experts, not associated with the government, should be given the right to do that. Don't you believe that's so?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
I found a lot of irony in your playing of the Buckley interview with that Mark Ling.
Yeah, it was. It was actually just something I happened upon. And I just decided to keep playing it. And, yeah, that was William Buckley with Mark Lane. And that was over blackopradio.com, I think, had that. And it's a pretty good show.
There's a significant irony in all of this, because knowing now that Buckley was recruited into the CIA right out of Yale.
Yeah. You were asking when we were off air when that was from. That was from December 1966, so I think this would have been just about the time Rush to Judgment, Mark Lane's first book, came out. There was a lot of, it was new. It was new. Everything going on was new.
Right. We didn't even have the Zapruder film. The Zapruder film, for your younger listeners, now understand, it turns out there were probably several. We didn't have video in the, it was film basically, right? It was like Super 8 or 35 millimeter. There were probably several of these, but the Secret Service ran around and scooped them all up right off the streets of Dallas. The infamous Zapruder film was, ended up in the hands of the publisher of Time Life, yep. Life magazine, a guy named B.D. Jackson, who was in the OSS, in the World War II OSS, so he was a CIA guy. They bought the film from Henry Booth Lewis, and they locked it away for 5 years after the Kennedy assassination. It was only released in 1968 as a consequence of the Jim Garrison case down in New Orleans, and when people saw it, And of course, I know that James Fetzer has a site called Assassination Science where he deconstructs the Zapruder film and points to instances where frames were rearranged or moved and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But one way or another, even looking at that, it's pretty clear it was shot from the front.
Definitely.
One of the most memorable events of my life was a recording I heard of the Monterey Pop Festival out in California. It would have been, I guess, in 67. Yes, 1967. One of the great rock and pop festivals.
Actually, let me cut in real quick.
David Crosby was with the Birds.
Yo, hold on. I know where you're going.
At this festival, and before they did this song that had been written by Roger McGuinn called "He Was a Friend of Mine," which was about the Kennedy assassination. David Crosby shouted out to the crowd from the stage, and it's on the commemorative CD set that you can get of this festival. David Crosby shouted out to from the stage, "Hey guys, have you seen the film out? That Zapruder film that's out. Kennedy was hit from the front. They shot him from the front." And here he is saying this on the stage to thousands of hippies. That's exactly what they were called back then. And this was broadcast, actually. People knew about it. It was quite shocking. 5 years. And now, in retrospect, it turns out that no one who sat on the Warren Commission got to see the Zapruder film. And they didn't get to see any x-rays from the assassination either. They didn't examine any forensics. What they saw were drawings that were done supposedly by the doctors at Bethesda Naval Hospital to perform the autopsy. I can go on about the Kennedy assassination at great length. The irony to me is that here was William F. Buckley, fresh out of Harvard. And I want to check and see if he was Skull and Bones. Maybe not. Maybe he was like one of the other society. What's the one that Bob Woodward is in?
Scroll and Key.
Scroll and Tanner.
No, actually, no. He's definitely Skull and Bones.
It's not like the Hasty Pudding Club at Harvard where they have to get up and drag, right?
he was Skull and Bones.
At Yale. Buckley went to work in Mexico City for Howard Hunt, later Watergate fame, but we know now, from the most recent Alex Jones interview with Hunt's son, that Hunt was right there in Dallas the day of the assassination. And so here's his former protege, with his own television show now, Firing Line, which growing up in the 60s and early 70s, I have to say, I don't think I missed one of his shows, because that was what you turned on to watch these so-called radicals he brought on. Like Black Panthers and Tom Hayden, and he may have had yippies on there. I'm not sure about that. But here was Buckley being trotted out to discredit Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment. And we didn't even have the Zapruder film yet, as you say. What we're listening to is from 1966. Imagine what that discussion would have sounded like if the Zapruder film had been released in 1966 instead of 1968.
Well, actually, I think when it was released, one thing that confused the issue for a while was they published the stills in Time Life magazine, and those two key frames where his head goes forward were out of order, so it looked more like his head went back.
I actually have that issue. I'm going to have to show this to you sometime. I have that issue, and I have other issues, and I didn't actually get them at the time. I've acquired them about 15 years ago at a flea market. I came across a pile of these. They're in excellent condition. So yeah, absolutely. I have a collection of about 25 old Life magazines from the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. And that particular issue where they published the rearranged frames, and there's probably missing frames there as well, of the Zapruder film, that has now become legendary. Plus, the fake picture of Oswald supposedly holding the rifle in the commie newspaper, all that stuff. I mean, the Kennedy assassination in retrospect looked so cheap and tacky, but then, it's 9/11 without all the fancy pyrotechnics. Who would they have really expected to believe the magic bullet theory? I mean, it's absurd, and so the bottom, and the irony is once again, that William F. Buckley would be out there knowing, he probably knew that Hunt had been in Dallas. And people like Buckley were perfectly relieved to see Kennedy out of the way. I mean, he was trying.
Most definitely. I got another. I actually have. He was a friend of mine by the Byrds from their 1965 number one album, Turn, Turn, Turn. I have it queued up, and I know that story about the Monterey Pop Festival. Let me ask you this. Did they change any of the lyrics? Because actually, that was an old kind of folk song that Roger McGuinn worked over to be about the Kennedy assassination. And so I was wondering, were the Monterey, did McGuinn change the lyrics from the album version to indicate it was a conspiracy, or did he stick with his Oswald version of the song? Well, I know he did. I know he did when he first wrote it.
I believe that this was a lone nut that did this. But it is kind of ironic that, you know, it's almost like, in a way, you don't pay much attention to the lyrics of the song when they're singing it, you know, after what you've heard David Crosby say. So, it's kind of funny.
Did Crosby say that before or after the song?
Well, Monterey Pop was in 67.
No, before or after the song was performed?
I'm pretty sure he said it before the song was performed.
But then Roger McGuinn left the Lone Nut lyrics in the song when they performed it anyway, right after Crosby said that.
I see the point you're making here, and some of your more attentive listeners will see the point you're making as well, and I think I agree with it. That I would love to be a fly on the wall at some of the arguments, the violent arguments that took place between McGuinn and David Crosby about everything having to do with the group until David Crosby was finally driven out and went on to get together with Graham Nash and Stephen Stills to form Crosby, Stills, and Nash, which I think really was, you know, went on to do great creative and original things, and the Byrds, I think, sort of faded a bit. They basically became a country and western band, which I think is what McGuinn always wanted to be.
Yeah, well, actually, Crosby... Crosby was
last week or two raising money for public television, and he played a kind of real vanilla, you know, almost, I mean, Turn, Turn, Turn has been played to death so much. Pete Seeger wrote the song.
Well, actually, let me point this out, Cy Girl. Crosby was also good friends with Paul McCartney and some kind of collaborators before he was killed. And actually, I believe in the Beatles' final press conference before James Paul McCartney was killed, David Crosby is actually hiding behind the curtain. And the press actually calls David out on that, and he comes out from behind the curtain. So I thought that was interesting in many ways. And I think if you get the CD version of Turn, 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 one of the bonus tracks in there is the instrumental version of Crosby's Stranger in a Strange Land, which also ties into a lot of what was going on with John and Paul McCartney, because that, of course, was a Heinlein novel, which was also part of the David Bowie out the Ziggy Stardust thing, which is kind of a combination of Stranger in a Strange Land and Paul McCartney.
Stranger in a Strange Land was a momentous it really was one of the, you know, you think about, you know, maybe the top 10 books that drove the 60s, things like Electric Kool-Aid, Acid Test, and Steal This Book, and that's one of the that's one of the most influential books that was published at the time. Actually, probably been published a little bit earlier. Heinlein, Stranger in a Strange Land.
It was definitely earlier. It was in 61. Heinlein was way ahead of his time.
Yeah, definitely far-sighted, and so many of his novels are so prescient. You could do a couple shows just on Heinlein's novels, which I think are very important for people to study, to understand and put in perspective the emergence of what has come to be called the ascendancy of the scientific dictatorship, as the Collins brothers call it in their magnum opus. Heinlein and others, I don't know about Asimov, but Heinlein definitely, you know, I think foresaw this. There were some other points that we were going to make about Buckley. The fact that, and this always happens when one of these celebrity figures who they pumped up over generations kicks off. They kind of repackage their history. They did it with Richard Nixon. It was unbelievable to me how they repackaged Nixon. Some kind of martyr. But Buckley, yeah. Buckley's interesting. For example, Buckley was a supporter. Now, this is a guy who's supposed to be conservative, right? He was a supporter of the Panama Canal Treaty that was negotiated under Jimmy Carter's administration by Saul Linowitz.
Yeah, and Brzezinski, I'm sure, was involved somehow, too.
Yeah, you know, and basically the reason why Buckley was for it is because he went down there and made great friends with the dictator of Panama at the time, General Omar Torrijos. This would be at a time when Manuel Noriega was just basically an up-and-coming officer in the Panamanian Defense Forces. And so this dictator president of Panama, Torrijos, charmed the pants off Buckley. Buckley came back and wrote all kinds of columns praising this man, because this was still the height of the Cold War. And it wouldn't matter. It didn't matter what kind of drug dealing, you know, sadistic, sociopathic gangster or military dictator you were hooked up with, as long as they were, you know, going to help you out against, you know, the evil empire, the Soviet Union, they were cool. And so Buckley, on those grounds, was a very, very enthusiastic supporter of the Panama Canal Treaty. He went around the country debating opponents of the treaty. These would be your more nationalistic conservatives.
And just to remind people, of course, this guy Buckley died yesterday.
And they're making a pretty big deal out of it in the corporate mainstream media. He's one of their big ideologues. He has been canonized as the intellectual founder of the modern conservative movement in America, along with Barry Goldwater, I guess. Although, to me, Buckley and Goldwater were two very, very different people. And I wonder if Goldwater even realized that Buckley was a... He must have known Buckley was a CIA agent.
I'm sure he must have figured it out at some point.
Came out of the closet, you know, came out on it. But back to the point I was going to make about that, I forgot what we were talking about.
Oh, sorry, we got all twisted up, and I mean, I don't know, where to go.
Oh, guess who he debated? Who was opposed to supposedly giving the canal back to the Panamanians was Ronald Reagan, who at that time, I guess, was maybe governor of California.
Yeah, well, remember, Reagan was anti-trilateral commission and anti-CFR right until the 1980 Republican National Convention, where he was forced to accept George Bush onto the ticket.
Absolutely, that's how they managed that. And the other thing about Buckley is, if you look at National Review and everything that it has spawned, of course, most people know now National Review has nothing to do with true conservative ideology. It's basically a kind of a neocon rag. All along, I would pose the question, how authentic is the modern American so-called conservative movement when you consider that its founder was from the very beginning a CIA agent? It tells me that movement was always rigged, was always controlled.
Well, I mean, let's be a little clear here. William F. Buckley found, you can call him the founder of the conservative movement, but what he did was he started a magazine in 1954 when he was like 22, 23 years old. There were people, there were conservative people before 1954.
Certainly you had, economists like Milton Friedman, von Mises, and Hayek, and all those people, but, the one I would want to put on the spot is Ron Paul.
Well, I think the point you made was, movement. It's the so-called conservative movement that, that was founded by the CIA, not so much a school of thought. Because the point is to have no thought.
Yeah, right, and that's what Buckley effectively became. He became a gatekeeper. For example, when the Ayn Rand objectivists showed up, Buckley denounced them in the pages of the National Review because they were atheists. And I guess the program at that time, one of the weapons in the global geostrategic fight with the Soviet Empire, the evil communist empire, was this, we believe in God and they don't. They're godless.
Yeah, it just turned into a series of denunciations and purges.
Yeah, that's when they put "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance, which was written by a socialist anyway in World War One. But Buckley...
Actually, before World War One, it was written by Edward Bellamy, like in the 1890s, I believe.
Bellamy. His brother, the one you're talking about, was the novelist.
No, I think it was the same guy.
Oh, okay, maybe it was. It was one of the Bellamy brothers. As a propaganda vehicle, I thought it was basically done as kind of a propaganda vehicle to build support to go into war, but just before World War One, to sort of, this idea, to build this ideology of loyalty to the federal government.
Well, they certainly ramped it up, and that's when they would have started making it more mandatory in schools and everything. But, the guy, it's also an ode to a powerful central state. One nation, indivisible. I object to indivisible more than under God, because if you want to get technical, it was kind of a little bit more under God than it was indivisible. I mean, they kind of made it to be divisible, and, at least they did throw out the word creator in the Declaration.
Yeah, indivisible, what does that mean? That's like the Fasces. That's like that, the sticks wrapped in the bundle with the axe. It was a symbol of the Roman Republic, but it's also a symbol of fascism, so it depends on the...
Well, it's an anti-secessionism thing.
Yeah, the significance National Review wrote these savage, savage attacks on Ayn Rand and these Ayn Rand objectivists. So it was pretty clear that maybe the establishment, the real establishment, were a little bit uncomfortable about these Ayn Rand types.
But see, but now the objectivist movement is the same thing, and they've in many ways kissed and made up with the National Review, because they're all radically pro-war, and some of them are like total genocidal maniacs.
Leonard Peikoff, who's sort of...
Exactly.
He claims to be the heir to Ayn Rand's literary estate, although the movement is really split up at this point. He was on the air on ABC Nightline within a fortnight of 9/11. And how often does a figure, you know, an Ayn Rand objectivist get on the air on Nightline? Well, one of these nationally televised shows broadcast to millions. And what does he say? You know, Ted Koppel's asking him about, well, what should be the nation's response to 9/11? And this guy, Leonard Peikoff, starts screaming hysterically that we need to bomb Iran. Bomb Iran. That's what he said. We have to bomb Iran. We have to bomb Iran now. And he kept saying it. If there's a tape of that out there, someone ought to post it on YouTube. Because it is hilarious. I was watching this and I thought, oh my God, this moron, he gets this once-in-a-lifetime chance to go on the air right after 9/11. What does he do? You know, how does he show Ayn Rand objectivism in its best light? He's screaming to bomb Iran. But to me, that kind of sums up the weaknesses of her thinking and their movement anyway. And I don't want to get into
Yeah, no, there's no need for that. Well, actually, since you got me on the tangent earlier about Heinlein and the Beatles, actually, that reminds me, I did want to get some rock and roll conspiracy stuff out of the way and then play the rest of that Dick Gregory. So I think I'm going to let you go.
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of interesting because he knew, Dick Gregory knew he was surrounded by devils. Wanted to knock out here this clip from the Power Hour a while back where the host claims that he has information about some kind of conspiracy regarding authorship of a number of Beatles songs, and this is quite interesting. And then we're gonna have some this is Dick Gregory speaking at the State of the Black Union in New Orleans with it was this long day-long thing, this horror show put on by Tavis Smiley, who's like this weird corporate PBS smiling black man on BET and PBS, and you might remember he hosted like the special all-black presidential debates, and he tried to sell his book during the debate. He's really weird, and so they had this thing with all these politicos, and like Tavis Smiley, it's all on C-SPAN, Tavis Smiley standing up there with like all these corporate logos behind him, like McDonald's and shit.
They basically gave mortgages to bad credit risks, you know. And especially they sold mortgages to people who they didn't even know what they were getting into. And Wells Fargo is being sued now by several cities, I believe. So the irony of this is you can see how the shakedown operates. And this is essentially what those elements within the black community who have mastered the art of identity politics form a business partnership with the corporate globalists and shake down. You know, and in return, they get a shake, they get a payoff, right? Jesse Jackson will show up with a group of picketers.
You know, I was thinking about one of these guys.
Of course, they don't want to mess around with that stuff. You now have this parasitic relationship between these people, Sharpton, Jackson. They're supposed to be the leaders.
Yeah, here's another one for you, Michael Brown.
But they're leading them.
And, you know, there's talk of the levees being blown up at some point. I'm going to try to get that audio for you also, but Dick Gregory just going nuts. This is pretty good stuff, so check it out.
Dick Gregory. They laughing already, and you ain't said nothing yet. That's when you know you're good, Dick. For Dick Gregory, we know that the media loves to build people up and then tear them down. There is no arguing the very favorable media coverage that Mr. Obama has received. So, what's next?
Well, let me say this first. I need to apologize for you giving me credit that I don't deserve as an entertainer. There's people on this stage in this room here have done more in one day than all the entertainers and athletes have put together in a lifetime. There's nobody on this planet have ever been liberated by entertainer or athlete. And I was glad when they took that girl's medals away, because I'm tired of Negroes going to the Olympics and outrunning God and then run around with a flag bigger than Kansas City trying to get on a Wheaties box top. But they have never said thanks to my black coach that taught me the fundamentals. Thanks to my black church that gave me the money to go to some dual meets where I could run. That day have to be over. Now let me say this. All we said here, what needs to be said, we think an illegitimate child is a child that don't know where their daddy is. America is an illegitimate child because she has no mother. And this is what the problem is. If I work in a coal mine, in a steel mill, and I come here today and put on a suit but don't take a bath, yes, you got stink sitting up here with you. And what has happened to America? We ain't never cleaned up the filth over 400 years. We just put a new suit on and a new dress on and then wonder who's stinking. It's you the one that's stinking. That's what this is. And until we clean this out, until we clean it up, my mama used to grab me and wash my face. America ain't got no mama that's washing her face. She'd pick my nose when it need to be opened up. She'd look in my ears. All we do is we went from this filth we was in to putting on some new clothes, and nobody has said, hey, somewhere we got to apologize. First, the black women. White women's okay, but that black woman went through racist white system and sexist black me. And we ain't never said what you've been through. And in spite of that, look at that black woman. Look at Kathy Hughes. She didn't have the privilege of a ladies' movement when she's putting that empire together. Look at Dorothy Height, huh? Look at all these women that have come through. The late Dolores Tucker. Look at what's going on now with E. Faye Williams talking about Sojourner Truth. And we will have that statue in the White House. Our women, if you think this sister just a politician, what she had to go through to get there, because she was a woman. And we have never slowed up and said, thank you, ladies. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And until we do that, until we're able to do that, I look at Dr. Condoleezza Rice. Hear me. And we tolerated. She has more PhDs than the president's whole cabinet. Hear me too, black folks. They call her Condi, but they never call Madeleine Albright Maddie. Never call Janet Reno Janny. Huh? Okay? And let me tell you, she don't see nothing wrong with it. Let me tell you something. They got a soda pop in America, Kissinger. And let me tell you, hear me too, black folks. They call her Condi, but they never call Madeleine Albright Maddie. Never call Janet Reno Janny. Okay? They call Henry Kissinger Dr. Henry Kissinger. And let me tell you, she don't see nothing wrong with it. Let me tell you something. They got a soda pop in America. Blacker than her, they call Dr. Pepper.
full title, say, give me a pepper, they'll give you a chili pepper. That's what we have to do, is clean this filth up.
Clean it up.
And once we clean our spirit and our soul, man, I love being alive. When that white boy went into that Amish church and wiped them out, that school, and not 2 weeks later, not after they consulted with nobody, 2 hours later, damn white folks say, we forgive him, and went to his funeral and hugged his wife. That's what love is about. Y'all talking about love, but can you be lovable? Then I'm safe with you, and you safe with me. This is what this is about. And what we, I wish Bill Clinton was here, so I would apologize to him for you black folks. You, now, I mean that. See, you black folks tricked him. You went in that big old black pot and said, here, white boy, you black. And then you went back in that black pot and said, here, Obama, you ain't black enough. What kind of fool is you? Huh? What kind of fool is you? Obama, too white. You did. And so if Bill was here, I said, Bill, I'm going to apologize to you. Because black folks not only told you, but tricked you. See, I have a son, a chiropractor now, Christian. He's 8 years old. He came to me crying. He said, Daddy, my brothers and sisters is laughing at me. I said, why? He said, well, I built me one of these castles that I make like it's my house. And do you see anything wrong with that? I said, well, how old are you, boy? He said, 8 years old. I said, no, ain't nothing wrong with that until you try to start using it as your address. So I tell Bill Clinton, ain't nothing wrong with being black, wrong with your plan. But when you try to use it as your address... some serious questions. Have you and your wife and your daughter ever been standing on a street corner in New York and a cab passed you by because you were a black president? Huh? Huh? Have you ever had Chelsea pulled over by the white police because our daddy's the black president? Mr. President, do you know what it feels like to be a black person? To be a Congress lady? Huh? To be a lieutenant governor? With 12 doctor's degree and driving down the street and hear the police siren and you start squeezing that steering wheel tight and they pass by you and you thank God. Damn thanking God. You didn't do nothing in the first place. Huh? Do you know what you did? Didn't you fly? Huh? Didn't you fly? Huh? Didn't you fly? That's what this is about. Huh? And then when you leave, with all the hassle, can you have that love? I'm so tired of you black folks walking around looking all evil like that's gonna change something. Looking all mean and talking all crazy. Let them tell you about your children. If I sit here today, and these are all white folks, and they're putting some sleeping pill in my water, and I sit up here and doze off and go to sleep, and everybody told in the world, niggas is lazy. They tired. No, that's because you too naive enough to know what they putting in my water. Okay? Your children ain't violent because they black. They ain't violent. Most people in the world live in a ghetto. They don't kill people. What are you putting in my malt liquor, white boy? What are you putting in? Huh? Here and you ain't checked it to see what's in it. Huh? How much lead are you putting in my neighborhood? Lead affects my thinking capacity. Lead, there's only one thing on the planet more dangerous than lead, and that's manganese. Manganese will make you kill your mama. And let me tell y'all something. If you want to see the largest homicide rate in the world, it ain't in no black ghetto in America. It's a little town in Australia where them white folks' homicide rate is 200 times what their population is. And that town just happened to be located across the street from a manganese plant. Big up of the hell.
Sit back down, Dick. Don't lose that mic. Yeah.
That town is located across the street from a manganese plant. How much manganese are you spraying in my neighborhood at night while I'm asleep? How in the world can a 9-year-old child find a heroin man, but the FBI can't find it, and you gonna tell me that's a black thing? Y'all crazy? What is this about? And then black men, as you run off to war and kill folks, liberate folks, and then come home in a white cop or a white racist mentality, then shot your mama in the back, and you got to call him. You don't call the United States government. You don't call that bad army. And black men, how can you let cops shoot your mama, your dad, and your daughter in the back and don't do nothing, but you notice they ain't never shot your car. They never took a nightstick and knocked your headlines out. And black men, you should feel ashamed that you think more of your car than you do your mama, than you do your daddy. Huh? These are the things that need to change while this brother and sister's on their way to the White House. And when you see Hillary and y'all see Brother Barack, thank him for me. And you white folks need to be thankful, because if y'all had a brother like me, y'all would really be in trouble. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay?
Ladies and gentlemen, Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory. Let me go down. I don't know how we're gonna follow that. Michael Steele said you don't. Let me go to Dr. Naeem Akbar.
Why don't you not go to Dr. Naeem Akbar? So, yeah, that was Dick Gregory going on, and we might have some more audio from that next week. I wanted to bring up now this clip from the Power Hour about the possible information regarding a Beatles songwriting conspiracy, and actually another doppelganger researcher called in to make the point. So it's pretty good. Let's check that out.
Minutes, but there are a couple things that we need. We're going to call this Freaked Out Friday because there's plenty of reason to get freaked out. Got a couple of things I want to get to, and we will have open lines. I'll start getting some phone calls in just a few minutes, but there are a couple of things that we need to be aware of. And first of all, before we even start, I want to apologize to those of you out there that were getting all keyed up about having us do this program about some Beatles music. Now, there is going to be a program about that in the future, but given the volatility and the controversy that will be created by this particular program that we want to do, complete with audio clips, we want to make sure we have all of our legal ducks in a row, because the last thing I need is to have an entire battalion of Yoko Ono's attorney breathing down our necks on this one. Want to make sure we have all of our facts straight, got everything you know, everything in line here, because if what we are about to, the story that I'm hoping to break sometime soon, if this is what I believe it is, this will rock the rock world. And it'll open up an entire new avenue of thought as far as some of the music that that changed history. So, but we will be getting to that, and again, I apologize to some of the folks that emailed me in great anticipation, looking forward to this. I had to postpone it here because there were just a couple of other issues that were not quite resolved yet. But maybe a little bit later on in the program, I'll bait the hook a little bit more. But it's going to be probably a couple of weeks before we can go forward with this. All right, enough said on that.
On the road to Rishikesh, I was dreaming more or less, and the dream I had was true. Yes, the dream I had was true.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour. Yeah, that is John Lennon, and that's a song that was eventually released on a solo album, and his first album, it became Jealous Guy. But originally, it was called...
I'm Just a Child of Nature.
A Child of Nature, and it is posted on YouTube. But the interesting thing is that there were many other songs that were planned to be released as Beatles songs, but never were. Well, we're going to be talking about that in the near future. Now, it's a show that we were planning on doing today, but unfortunately, there could be some legal repercussions. So we're holding off on this thing till all of our little duckies are in a row. So for those of you that that were you know, standing on the edge of your seat with bated breath waiting to hear this, I apologize sincerely for getting you all excited about this program. And hopefully, if this all comes together and we're able to play some of the clips that we do have here, this will be an exciting program, but we're going to have to hold off for a couple of weeks until everything is all set. So in the meantime, I got the Power Team members to keep me warm. And then again, for all of those that were anticipating this program that we've been preparing for, having to do with John Lennon and the Beatles and possible lost music that is in the process of being recovered, rediscovered, re-recorded, what have you, we're going to hold off on this. Because, well, let's just say there are certain litigious people out there that might not want this information coming out, and I want to make sure that my sorry butt's going to be covered if we're going to talk about this. So we're going to hold off on this thing, but I will promise you that this gives us a little bit more time to put some of the puzzle pieces together here, and if this is what I believe it to be, this could be a huge, huge story in the rock and roll history. Let's go to... another first-timer. Welcome to the Power Team, Bob in Pennsylvania. Hello, Bob.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, Dave, I'm one of those disappointed Beatles fans, but I'll tell you something.
Okay.
You're on to something, and I don't know who your guest is or what he's going to say, but I'm of the generation, I'm old enough to remember that night back in 1969, when the rumor came out that Paul was dead.
Oh, yes.
And if you're of my age, you can remember that night the same way that you do the day that Kennedy was shot. I mean, we took it pretty hard.
Yeah.
And because of that fascination, now we're in the age of the Internet, and mm-hmm. people have been looking into that mystery anew, with a new look. And
yeah.
I have to say, this is maybe a little bit of a teaser for the program to come. It seems to me, you Dave, know about the Bible code, and I think
yeah.
the listeners have heard of it.
Oh, sure.
Well, I think the Beatles have sort of done the same thing. They sort of put another message under the surface from their songs. I mean, All You Need Is Love is what's on the surface,
mm-hmm.
and then there's another little message hidden in there with all their other albums. And I just want to say that because maybe that'll inspire some people to... you know, tune up their ears a little bit when they're listening to the Beatles music, and then by the time your show comes around, they'll be a little more attuned to what you have to say.
Yeah, I don't know if that applies to where we're going with this. You know, I'm aware of the Paul is Dead controversy back in those days, and I remember, you know, the end of the song I'm So Tired, when you play it backwards, you know, Paul is a dead man, miss him, miss him, miss him now. I'm aware of all that. I mean, I wore some of my records out doing that stuff.
Yep.
But no, that's not where we're going with this particular issue here. So,
okay.
Yeah, we're dealing with something else. All I will say is that, well, for instance, going back to some of the early recordings of the Beatles, there were tunes in there that had piano, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But none of them played piano. So who played piano?
That actually does have a lot to do with where he's going. He just doesn't realize it. It's the point is that other people were writing Beatles songs and the Lennon McCartney songs, especially after the real James Paul McCartney died, and there was just kind of this more, even more of this corporate, all caps, Paul McCartney person.
George Martin.
Right.
Okay. So there were people happening behind the scenes. There were people that were helping them out behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes a lot of the stuff that, you know, of course, you know, George Martin didn't get credit for playing the piano on that album. There was no credit on there. But there were other folks that contributed in different ways to the music that never got credit.
Okay. Oh, sure. And I think if you look into, as I say, once you start looking into it, you find all kinds of curiosities in what was done.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Yeah. Well, no, I know that there were some interesting pieces of information hidden in some of those recordings. Some of it maybe was intentional, some of it wasn't. But that's not where we were going. Hey, Bob, I thank you so much for the call, and I apologize if I got you all excited about the upcoming program, but it will happen. We're just postponing for the time being.
Okay, that's great.
All right, guy. Hey, thanks for so much. Welcome to the Power Team.
News, politics, rumors, rants, and debates. It's the worldwide home of free speech radio. RevereRadioNetwork.com. Total free speech, even when it's ugly.
And you know, we're going to say the
throw my ticket out the window.